The Big Story is brought to you by Scotiabank. If you've been paying attention to the news, this has been a tough week. And it's been a tough week here on The Big Story, too. It's been especially tough on our producer, Claire Broussard. She has to listen to these episodes dozens of times. Claire?
Jordan?
What did we talk about this week?
We covered some pretty depressing stories. We talked about the very real possibility of a civil war in the States and how it could affect Canada.
Yes.
We talked about mental health and crime, more specifically a murder.
Yeah.
And we talked about a woman named Audrey Parker, a terminally ill woman in Halifax, who went through with a medically assisted death a little bit earlier than she would have liked to.
That story was inspiring, but heartbreaking.
Very heartbreaking.
And Claire, today you showed up, not even planning it, just wearing all black.
Yeah. It was unintentional. I think it's just, I'm feeling all the feels after this week.
It has been a week. But today is Friday and it's the weekend.
Mm-hmm.
And we are actually, despite the all black attire, Claire, we are celebrating.
We are. That's right. We are celebrating. We're celebrating some new podcasts.
We have just officially, as of yesterday, launched our brother and sister shows on frequencypodcastnetwork.com.
Woo!
Go check it out, please. We'll get to our story in just a second, and we'll tell you more about those at the end of the podcast, because we know you're here for us.
You're here for Jordan, really.
Well, you're here for the guest, and we're bringing you a conversation with a guest that just, man, Claire, after this week, it made me happy. If you're listening and you've had a tough week, it will make you happy too. It is about what makes us happy, how we measure it, and how happy we could be if we stopped to try. So quickly, for everybody listening and for you, Claire, on a scale of 1 to 10, how happy are you?
Like right now?
Yeah, right now. That's the point of the exercise.
Well, honestly, after this past week, I don't know, 4? It's pretty low.
Okay. Now, everybody listening, you have your number. Look at the person in the car next to you or sitting across the subway aisle or next to you in bed, or think about just the last person you saw. How happy do you think they are? How good a judge of it do you think you are? Because the study of happiness is older than you think and it's tougher to predict. And just when you think you have a handle on what makes somebody happy and what factors can drag that happiness down, a new study comes out to surprise you. So who do you think are the happiest people in Canada? And if I made you guess, would you pick people at the opposite ends of almost everything? Because according to Statistics Canada, the happiest people in Canada are teenage boys and elderly women. Want to know what their secrets are? We're going to tell you, and hopefully make you a little happier while we do it. I'm Jordan Heath Rawlings. This is The Big Story, and this is an episode you should just listen to, not while playing on your phone, not while staring at a screen. Trust us, you will be happier for it. John Helliwell is perhaps Canada's leading happiness expert. He is a professor emeritus at the University of British Columbia, and he has done decades of research into what makes us happy. So, John, first, what is happiness, and how do you academically quantify it?
The best measure that we use looking across communities and across age groups and across countries is a simple answer to a question on a scale of 0 to 10. How satisfied are you with your life as a whole these days?
And how does that work? How do you find people respond to that?
Easily, among all the questions they're asked on surveys, as opposed to asking them about their income, where a third of the people won't tell you, this is a question that everybody is happy to answer, and they answer quite quickly, which means they don't have a lot of trouble making up their mind.
That's interesting, because I would think you'd do some introspection when you looked at a question like that.
Well, it's true that this is life as a whole you're looking at, not sort of what's your mood like at the moment. Those questions are asked too, and they're interesting. You could imagine the mood fluctuating more according to what you're doing at the moment and after lunch and before lunch and so on. These life evaluations don't have weekend effects, and they don't vary so much with the weather and the so on. So they do imply a certain amount of introspection. But maybe, you know, once it's in your mind, then it sits there, and so you could haul it out quite quickly.
How long has the study of happiness been going on?
about 40 years, I think. I mean, that's doing Aristotle a dirty, because he said he started it a couple of millennia ago, and he wasn't even the first in the field. But it's only in the last 40 years or so that in labs, and even more importantly, out in the streets, we're able to get big samples of people answering these questions, and then we're able to put more flesh on the science. So when I started this in this field about 20 years ago, I described myself as Aristotle's research assistant, because we now had enough numbers to test his propositions, and most of his propositions came through with flying colors.
What are those propositions?
That your friends and family are fundamental. Good health is fundamental. Enough material resources to keep food on the table. Very importantly, a sense of purpose, a feeling that your life has a purpose, is really important. About the only thing that we find in the modern research that he didn't emphasize quite so much, although it's maybe implicit in what he was saying, is generosity. People really do enjoy their lives better when they are doing and have done things for other people. One thing he did mention is a sense of freedom, and that does come through in the data very well. And something else, to operate in a trustworthy environment, to be able to feel that other people are covering your back and vice versa.
None of that. Well, I shouldn't say none of that, but a lot of that doesn't sound like stuff that is emphasized in our current culture, at least the waters we swim in, where, you know, social media plays such a huge role in our lives and the news cycle is 24/7 and our phones are connected all the time. So I wonder if you've been seeing any sort of overall trends in terms of happiness of Canadians or even of people in the developed world in general, which has sort of the climate I'm talking about.
The question you raise is a very good one. What does a faster-paced life or a less immediate connection, because we know from lots and lots of research that face-to-face really beats anything more distant, and so the more human contact there is, the happier people are. We have done some studies using a large sample of Canadian data from a Léger poll, of comparing the happiness of people according to the size of their networks of real friends and their networks of online friends.
Well, that's interesting.
The bigger your network of real friends, the higher you rate your life, and the online network size has zero effect. And in some parts of the demographic, it's negative.
That makes me feel really bad about my Twitter account.
Well, you may want to rethink it. There are, as you and everyone else knows, there are some addictive features to the accessibility of the latest word from anywhere, friend, enemy, or news, that drags people back to it every time the machine goes ding. And if that stops you from talking to the person you've come to the restaurant with, well, that's so much worse for both of you.
Up next.
I think it's probably true that we run our educational institutions, and indeed in many cases our families, so as to put high expectations on the young. And so that ends up putting pressure on people.
You can save like never before with the Scotiabank Momentum Plus Savings Account. And now, for a limited time, you can earn up to 3.2% interest until March 10th. You can find all the terms and conditions at scotiabank.com/MP. I'm sure we're probably not the first people to call you about the recent Statistics Canada data that found the two happiest groups of people in Canada: teenage boys, age 15 to 19, and women over 70. What were your thoughts when you saw this research? What was your initial reaction?
Well, of course, I've been working with these data for 20 years, so there's no surprises in any of that. But one of the features that has been apparent in most countries, not all countries, we did in 2015 have a chapter on how does well-being vary by gender and age all over the world. So we had these data for every country. And for most countries like ours, the sort of industrialized countries, there's a U shape in age where it starts high and drops to middle age and then rises later on. And we call that, some people call it a midlife crunch or time crunch or everything else crunch, where expectations are high and time is short and you're running from pillar to post. It varies a little between countries as to whether the old age part is happier than the youth part. In Canada, it's one of those countries where it keeps rising as life satisfaction with age right up into the over 75 group. So that for both men and women, the over 75s are happier than the 15 to 24s. The girls happier over 75 and the boys happier under 25. And the latter one is newer. What we've found over the last decade or so is that as young women have been increasingly outperforming their male peers in perseverance and performance in academics and almost everything else, their happiness has been dropping relative to the boys. And one view of this is that their expectations are being raised for them and by them even faster than their performance. So they're anxious about their performance, even though it's been rising very impressively.
That's such a sad story that it would happen like that. As you get more opportunity, the expectations rise and your happiness goes down?
It is, and I think there are important lessons there. I think it's probably true that we run our educational institutions, and indeed, in many cases, our families, so as to put high expectations on the young for performance, whether for grades to get into college or you name it. And so that ends up putting pressure on people that despite the fact they're performing much better than you might have thought sitting back 10 or 20 years ago, they're not feeling any happier. And that really will require a rethinking of how we set our objectives and how we design schools and indeed families so as to keep people happy in the process. Because if you're really going to learn, if you're really going to be curious, you're going to do it from a base of being happy, not a basis of anxiety. You don't learn as fast when you're anxious.
I wasn't a unique teen or anything, and certainly that's obviously anecdotal, but I don't remember that being like a particularly happy time in my life. I certainly, looking back, wouldn't say it was when I was the happiest, but maybe that's just hindsight. Do we have any idea how they report this and what causes it?
Well, they report it the same way as everybody else. They're asked this question on the scale of 0 to 10.
Yeah, but if teen girls are outperforming them in almost every facet, then it seems so weird that their happiness would be so high. You would think, because we always hear the discussion in the media that, you know, we have a real problem with young boys and we need to talk about our teen boys and toxic masculinity and all that kind of stuff. And it's clearly not reflected in this data.
Well, it isn't that they're that much happier than the girls. I mean, it's a tenth of a point
okay.
1% on a 0 to 10 scale. Similarly, the women, over life as a whole, women are happier than men by almost that amount. So it's only in that demographic. But you're quite right to ask the question, because you say, well, I can understand that. So maybe we ought to be thinking about it, not that the boys are especially happy, but that the girls in this situation of expectations rising, relative even when performance is, and maybe they're more inclined to pay attention to the expectations than the boys are. The girls are becoming less happy and the boys are hanging in there. There's sort of a what me worry feature about it. And they'd say, what boy's problem? And whether that's linked or not to the fact that they spend a lot of their time playing games that sort of take you out
right.
of the real world. So they may be living in an illusory situation. If so, of course, that illusion will eventually crumble.
How much of it depends on your own outlook? You know, I know we talk a lot about you have to be an optimist, you have to look on the bright side, you know, you define your own feelings and that kind of thing. Do you know how much sort of a person's makeup of what kind of person they are plays into this?
Well, there are some some studies that say up to a third or a half of the differences across people are innate in their own DNA. Of course, now we've looked at that around the world, we realize, of course, that isn't true, and that they were previously based on identical twins raised apart or together. But the trick is the ones who were raised apart were raised in almost entirely the same social circumstances as the ones raised together.
Right.
So you weren't really, you were getting the limited genetic effects looking like a big share of the total. Is the actual genetic part is pretty small for the differences from the happiest to the least happy people. It's tiny. Attitudes, and here, you know, we're harking back to what we were saying about expectations and performance. It's clearly possible to change your expectations for yourself. It's totally possible to change your framing of what's happened in the past. After all, if you couldn't change the framing and emphasize the good parts and downplay the pain, we probably wouldn't have multi-child families. So that reframing is really important. And you can think of an optimist as somebody who doesn't forget the bad things that have happened, because if you forget them at your expense, right, because you're supposed to have learned some lessons about hot stoves and other things through the bad things that have happened.
Yeah.
But you can encapsulate them. You take the lesson and then you go on and look for things that are better while you polish and cherish the happy moments and put them on the shelf and gaze at them every so often. And one of the arguments that some psychologists have made about why, at starting from the age of 30, there's a increase in people's ability to is that that's something that's learned, that about that age people start being better at putting the negatives in the past after taking the lessons from them and focusing on the future and the good things that are possible.
What would you recommend as the kind of simplest step people could take right now to try to improve their happiness?
Well, I think the first thing is to say, what could you do to improve someone else's happiness? It turns out in the long run, that'll also improve your happiness. But don't think about that. Think about what you could do to improve other people's happiness. And that may make you a little less shy and may make you a little, and if so, that's good. Reach out and make more connections with people. Use the traffic wave rather than the traffic insult. Deliberately do good turns for other people. And it, of course, changes the social climate quite quickly. We find that life is happier in the small towns than the big cities. And the main reason for that is that these kind of day-to-day, minute-to-minute, hour-to-hour social relations with other humans are easier to achieve and more, are naturally more friendly in the smaller environments where you keep seeing the same people. So to do it in big cities, you've got to reach out and make an effort. And what our research says is that effort is really worthwhile.
Can I tell you, we're a daily news podcast, so we cover news every day. And compared to what we normally talk about, this has been such a life-affirming conversation.
I've got one more story for you that will play into exactly that comment.
Oh, perfect. We need it.
Turns out that for one reason or another, we adopted a trust question, which was then picked up by the Statistics Canada and is now going to be used in the Gallup World Poll, that asked people, if you had dropped a wallet with identification and money in it and lost it, how likely do you think it is to be returned if it's found by a police officer or a neighbor or a stranger? Separate questions for each. And we had a lot of these data available. And we knew that for Toronto, the expected wallet return, if it was found by a stranger, was 25%. Well, the Toronto Star, bless their hearts, and not realizing we had this scientific base in the background, they dropped 20 wallets in Toronto. And guess how many of them were returned?
Do you want me to actually guess?
Why not?
8.
16.
Wow.
So 80% wallet return, the expected was 25%. The likelihood of people being right about the generosity and empathy of their fellow citizens is about one chance in 8 billion. So what it really means is the news feeds we do get about other people are routinely too pessimistic about the actual humanity that your other fellow citizens have for you. If you walk down the street knowing that 80% of the time you lost your wallet, these people you see on the street are going to pick it up and take themselves out of their regular lives and make a real effort to get them back to you, you think differently about them. You're, of course, going to be more likely to smile at them. You're certainly going to be more likely to be polite in traffic. And for sure, you're going to be absolutely certain the next time you see a wallet, you'll pick it up and make sure it goes back to whoever lost it.
I'm going to be walking home through downtown Toronto in about half an hour, and I'm going to be thinking about that. Thank you so much.
My pleasure.
John Helliwell, University of British Columbia professor, happiness expert, happiness researcher, a much-needed dose of joy to end the week. That was The Big Story, brought to you by Scotiabank. You can earn, for a limited time, 3.2% interest until March 10th with the Scotiabank Momentum Plus Savings Account. Conditions apply. For more from us, of course, thebigstorypodcast.ca, but also, now and forever, frequencypodcastnetwork.com. It's the home of us. It's the home of our brother and sister shows, Black Tea, The Legal Podcast, Moms in the Middle, and The Quick and the Dirty. I won't spoil them for you, but visit the website, check them out, let us know what you think. We always want to hear your feedback. And of course, if you want The Big Story, you've got us on social media at Big Story Podcast on Twitter, on Facebook, on Instagram. And you can subscribe to any of the podcasts I just mentioned, as well as our own, for free wherever you get podcasts. They are all, as of today, on Apple, on Google, on Stitcher, on Spotify. Please have a look, have a listen. I'm Jordan Heath Rawlings. Thanks for listening. We'll talk to you on Monday. Have a happy weekend.